Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
What up? It's Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. That just happened. The Doug Gottlieb Show rolls on here on Fox Sports Radio. Coming to you live from sunny Southern California. And, all right, so we have World Series champions. World Series champion, the LA Dodgers. John Ramos is happy. Ryan Music is happy. Most people are happy. And look, I'm going to do something that it's going to be hard to do, which is defend the Tampa Rays. That's right. I'm going to defend the Tampa Rays because here's what happens. Okay, last night in the sixth inning, Kevin Cash comes out and gets Blake Snell. And look, Snell was absolutely dealing. Now, I don't think anybody thought the game was going to end up 1-0, right? Like, that's not Bob Gibson out there. On the other hand, he pitched as well or better than Bob Gibson ever has. And so, when you watch last night, you were sitting there going, no, don't end. Of course, Blake Snell drops an F-bomb. He clearly did not want to come out of the game. It's not like he thought he was losing his stuff. But what the Rays are, what the Dodgers are, is what baseball has become. It's what baseball has become, which is, this is what we've done all year. Why would we do anything different? And in all honesty, like the old coaching adage has always been, you know, stay true to who you are. Stay true to what you are. Remember what got you where you are. And so for the Rays, much like the Dodgers, right? Like we can criticize the front office for the information that's provided, the plan that's in place, the lack of flexibility with that plan, because that's really what it comes down to. It's not that the Rays plan was bad. It's that they didn't see or weren't willing to bend on the idea that, hey, Blake Snell was better than any number would tell you he should be. There's no metric that tells you Blake Snell has as many strikeouts as anybody since Sandy Koufax in a World Series game. But he did. And we're talking about through five innings. Now, I don't think that the Rays lost the series last night. I think they lost it in game four when they ran themselves out of two innings. But I'm going to point out that, look, if I'm going to defend the Rays, it's this is who they are. This is what they've been. This is how they've accomplished what they've accomplished. By the way, the LA Dodgers are much the same story. Like, we can sit here and be critical of the idea that there's not critical thinking from Dave Roberts or from Kevin Cash and that Hal 9000 is deciding the games. We can be critical of that. But the reality of it is, that's why they hired Andrew Friedman, right? I mean, like, there's more to it, right? Andrew Friedman obviously has an eye for talent. Their use of analytics also tells you who's going to be the next stars, and they've done a great job of evaluation. And the difference with the Dodgers and the Rays is it's not just the talent they have, it's the depth of talent that they have that they can afford to go out and trade for Mookie Betts, give up some prospects, give up some players, and, oh yeah, by the way, pay Mookie Betts. These are things that Tampa can't do. I mean, if you line up guys and you line up talent, I mean, the fact is the Dodgers, that's a historically great baseball team. I mean, think about it. They win a series in which their best starting pitcher only starts once. They go six games, and we only saw Walker Buehler once. And oh yeah, by the way, they win a World Series, and their closer is completely and utterly ineffective. Right? The story of the Dodgers is going to be told. It's going to be about pulling Blake Snell a little bit, about Clayton Kershaw's two starts a lot, about Corey Sager, who just hot as all get out. Maybe about Justin Turner, who hits one to the warning track, then gets pulled because he's got COVID. Then he goes to the dugout. Then he tweets. Then he comes back out. Like, all of these will be told. I think what's interesting, Walker Buehler only pitched once. He's the best pitcher the Dodgers have. And they still won the series in six games. That's how good they are. But I'll defend the Rays and Kevin Cash because this is who they are. That's who they are. On the other hand, therein lies the flaw in statistical-based analysis. If you want to term it analytics, you want to term it high-level information, it takes away what sports so much is about, which is a feeling, right? I just got a sense that this guy, he's going to be okay. Now, look, stats told us that Pedro Martinez was done in 2003, but the feeling had Grady Little send him back out there, and the rest, of course, is history, and they blew the game and blew the series and lost to the New York Yankees, and it took them another year to recover and ultimately win their first World Series in 86 years. But a blind man could see that whatever the computer told you didn't factor in that Anderson, though a great regular season, shortened regular season pitcher, wasn't the same guy in the postseason. And that whatever you thought Snell was on paper, he was completely different last night. Here's the manager of the Rays, Kevin Cash, after the game.
Well, yeah, I guess I regret it because it didn't work out. I feel like the thought process was right. I mean, every decision that's made, that end result has a pretty, you know, weighing factor in how you feel about it. If we had to do it over again, I would have the utmost confidence in Nick Anderson to get through that inning.
Wow, that's what he said, huh? If I had to do it again, I would do it again? That's what he said? If I had to do it again, but that's not what he said, but he said I'd have the utmost confidence. He didn't say, if I had to do it again, I would do it again. He said, if I had to do it again, I would have the utmost confidence in him. Look, we've seen this so oftentimes with the Houston Rockets. I think the number one thing that everyone says that it doesn't account for is, you know, shortened series, is a gut feeling. I think the thing it doesn't account for is fatigue. Vince Lombardi's famous expression is, fatigue makes cowards of us all. It makes, by my estimation, Gottlieb says, it makes mortals of immortals. You take the best reliever in baseball in the regular season and he becomes utterly hittable. Why? Fatigue. They used him and used him and used him. And ultimately, it was too much, and a guy who was unhittable became hittable. That's what happens with the Houston Rockets. How else can you explain that James Harden is so ineffective in the postseason? Does he draw fewer fouls? I guess. But a lot of it comes from the fact that he doesn't play defense in the regular season, and now he tries to play a little bit of defense in the postseason. Combine that with the overuse in the regular season, the overuse in the postseason, played at higher level competition, and he doesn't have it in the tank. The only explanation for Kevin Anderson, it's not pressure, because it wasn't a one-game thing where all of a sudden a guy who is unhittable becomes hittable. It was throughout the playoffs he was hittable. He kept giving up runs. Seven games in a row, gave up a run. It's a league record for the playoffs. And the only explanation for that is not that the guy who pitched in high leverage situations in the regular season and in the postseason is somehow flawed in that he's prone to get tight during pressure. Is he tired? And stats don't necessarily account for that. I will defend the Rays because, much like the Dodgers, this is who they are. This is how they got there. You know, it's like when the Falcons had the 28-3 lead. Why'd they keep throwing? That's who they are. That's how they got there. Why the Houston Rockets keep shooting threes in game, was it seven? couple years ago against the Warriors, that's who they are. That's how they got there. But fatigue makes cowards of us all. It makes mortals of immortals. And it takes away the human factor, to which is anyone could see. Snell was dealing one hard hit ball. Does not a shot pitcher make. All right, coming up next in the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. We got a ton to get to. An absolute ton. What a great show we have for you. Ryan Music is back from, do we call it marital leave? Like what he got married? Married. Congratulations. He gets married. So that's a big thing. Congratulations to Ryan. Did you watch it on, did you watch the streaming of it?
Yes, I did.
You did?
Of course.
I thought the streaker was a little bit odd. I thought I'm not sure if that was paid to happen or exactly how that happened, but I thought the streaker was something I was not expecting when I turned on at 5 o'clock on Saturday. Ryan Music and his bride Kim getting married. I didn't expect that. Coming up next, one NFL team has told you all you need to know about how they intend to fix their season.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
What up, Doug Gottlieb Show? Fox Sports Radio. Hope you're having a great day, kiddos. Dodgers win the World Series. I saw this. Do you know who the Dodgers owe $8 million to next year? Scott Kazmir. Deferred salary.
Former Rays pitcher Scott Kazmir.
Right?
Yeah.
Former Ray, former
An Angel.
Met, former Angel.
Yeah.
There was a guy with a big reputation coming in. Massive reputation. He was a three-time All-Star. He was a former Ray, former Angel, former A, and then, of course, at the very end of his tenure, he was a Dodger. They absorbed that contract. They deferred the salary. He gets $8 million next year. Imagine being 37 years old, and you're getting $8 million to not do anything. Right? People ask all the time, like, what happens to these baseball players? Where are they? They are in Orange County on a golf course. Or in Florida on a golf course. That's what they're doing. They're dads. They're hitting guys. They're just hanging out. That's amazing. Made $63 million in 12 seasons, plus still making deferred salary, deferred compensation. That's crazy. Anyway. So congrats to the Dodgers. Daniel Jeremiah will join us in 20 minutes. We'll ask him about Tom Brady. We'll ask him about Antonio Brown being added to Tom Brady's wide receiving core. We're going to ask him about some of these trades that are being made. Of course, Carlos Dunlap, who was basically sent home and was a malcontent, didn't get along with the team. He was dealt today to Seattle, who gave up an offensive lineman. I have a question for Beyer, who is our resident Seattle Seahawk expert. Beyer, don't they need offensive linemen, right? Like, I know they have no pass rush at all. So I get why they went and got Carlos Dunlap, but don't they need offensive linemen?
Not necessarily. They've actually found a nice bit of a core. Dwayne Brown's been pretty good. Ethan Posick's moved over to the center spot. He's been all right. Damian Lewis, a guard out of LSU's been really good for them. So offensive line isn't necessarily much of a problem for them anymore. Not that it's one of the league's best, but it's been definitely serviceable for them.
All right. Well, they desperately needed a pass rush, right? I mean, they need a lot of things on the defensive side of the ball, and so that's why the Dunlap trade makes the most sense.
Yes, and it's, you know, Doug, we've done the show. I've been on your show for 3.5 years, and I think every time we talk about the Seahawks and their faults, the Legion of Boom was so great because of Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett, and guys in the middle being able to pressure the quarterback, and it is not meant to take anything away from Richard Sherman or Earl Thomas or Cam Chancellor, because they were great, great players. But it also helped when those guys were getting pressure on the quarterback. And I was even looking back at the Sports Illustrated cover when the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. It was Peyton Manning getting crushed by Michael Bennett on the cover.
And, oh, well, I mean, that thing was, it was, I was working for CBS Sports Radio at the time. And I remember going to New York for that Super Bowl. And we're getting ready for the Super Bowl. And everybody's, you know, everyone picked the Broncos because they had that offense where, the, you know, where there was seemingly unstoppable. That was the year after they had lost. He had the 50 touchdown year where they lost to the Ravens because he couldn't throw in the wind. And Flacco with that unbelievable completion, they beat him in Denver. So the next year, Denver's got a really good defense, but a spectacular offense. And I was sitting there just going like, yeah, everybody's off on this one. I picked the Seahawks to win because of that pass rush and because they could get home with four. And if they was it a fumble on the first? What was like the
it was
first
the snap? Manning went to step up and they snapped it. You know, went to change the call at the line of scrimmage, and
and they were never right, right? Like what happened to Tampa to Green Bay in Tampa 2 weeks ago? That's what it felt after Aaron Rodgers threw that pick. That's what happened after that snap. They could never get right. They could never block the Seahawks. And he was, and you know, like Peyton Manning, and when everything is perfect, he's great. But you got to make him, you make him move a little bit. Like yikes, he was under duress. So look, it makes sense what the Seahawks are doing. I understand why the Bengals are doing it. The big story of the day is that the Cowboys are cutting Don Terry Poe, who they just signed this year, and cornerback Daryl Worley. This is from Ian Rappaport, after trying to trade both. That's three veterans jettisoned in 2 days. Mike Florio from Pro Football Talk said that the Cowboys seem like they're in fire sale mode. No, they're not. They're not in fire sale mode. Here's what Jerry's doing. I'm going in and I'm finding out who the guys are who ain't buying in, and they're gone. Who I can get rid of. There's a limit to what you can do nowadays. Back in the old days, you'd go in and cut anybody. It didn't matter. But you can't go and cut Jalen Smith. You're on the hook for a big contract. You got other guys you can't cut because you're on the hook for a big contract. But a Don Terry Poe, a Daryl Worley. Who's the guy they traded yesterday? They traded another defense player yesterday. Like, these are dudes without big contracts that they'll either trade them for next to nothing or they'll just cut them straight out. That's how you have our attention. Right? Because you have one of two decisions when you're Jerry Jones. Fire the staff or fire the players. And you can't fire the really good ones, so you fire the ones who are fireable. It's a little bit like why Antonio Brown is, you know, going to be available. Was available and going to, I would guess, will be on his best behavior because now with his contract, he's imminently cuttable. The Steelers cut him even though they had to make, you know, even though they had to lose a bunch of money on it and lose some cap space. Same thing with the Raiders. Like, they was a losing proposition, but for the Buccaneers, it's like no money at all. It's all based upon, is he on the roster week to week, which means he should be on his best behavior. For the Cowboys, this is their way of getting the message across. We think we've still got enough. We don't know if we have enough. Let's just cut anybody who's not getting along, not fitting in, doesn't fit with what we want to do. That will motivate guys. And if that doesn't work, then we'll think about bigger changes like coaching changes and major player changes. By the way, Mike Florio floated out, there's one name to wonder about as the trade deadline approaches, receiver Amari Cooper. The Cooper deal was a bad deal. Cooper deal was a bad deal. And I don't think that anybody's going to take the bait on a $100 million contract where he's halfway through the first year of it. You're like, yeah, that's not one I'm taking. I'm going to take a bite out of. No thanks. Again, why? Because why would the guy behave, even if you have Devontae Adams as your number one and he becomes a really, really good number two, why would he be any better to deal with just because you traded teams? He's still under contract. He's still essentially uncuttable. But the Cowboys are doing, the Patriots trading Stephon, if they trade Stephon Gilmore, it's because they know they got no shot this year. This was their plan B. If it didn't work, let's get some picks. The Cowboys cutting guys, this is their way of trying to get every amount of juice they can out of that orange. Every amount of juice. Coming up next, more is not always more. Matter of fact, it's almost never more. One NFL team and their star wide receiver are going to learn that lesson the hard way. I'll share that with you next.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
Tom Pelissero joins us, a reporter for the NFL Network. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Pelissero. Tom, let's start with the Dallas Cowboys. You cut a couple dudes, you trade another guy, but there are some that think, all right, what about some of the bigger names and the bigger contracts? Will there be a big name moved from the Cowboys?
Not as of now, Doug, and I think that what you saw over the past couple of days with Everson Griffin being traded to Detroit and then Dontari Poe and Darryl Worley being released was just kind of a course correction based on what Mike McCarthy and Mike Nolan and that staff has seen so far. I mean, you have some high-paid veteran players who were not as good as advertised coming in. You're obviously struggling on defense, and yeah, the time where you're trying to learn a new scheme and you didn't have an offseason to do it. You know, I mean, in terms of big names, there aren't a whole lot left in terms of healthy guys. I mean, you're not going to move any of the top players on offense. They've been working without their top two quarterbacks now. They're down to top four offensive linemen. You're just kind of, you know, piecing together scraps there. And the offense on the whole, if you look at the numbers, has not been bad. It's really about the defense here. You know, if they had the opportunity to move, you know, certain players, a guy like Jalen Smith who's struggled, maybe that's a possibility, but you're talking about guys who make a lot of money. It's difficult to trade those contracts, which is the same thing they found out when they tried to trade Poe and Worley, and the answer around the league was no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I also think, like, Jerry's trying to figure out who's in and who's out in terms of what they want to do, not just how they fit, and, you know, cut somebody. Like, who can we cut that makes a big splash that we want to get rid of, but it's not going to kill us the way a Jalen Smith would kill him?
Right. Well, and also I think that it's about, you know, the culture that you really didn't have that off season to build. Not to say that those guys weren't fully bought in. I mean, Everson Griffin, if you've ever spent any time around him, he is 100% bought in to everything all the time. But what the Cowboys saw was a 32-year-old player who they felt had lost a step. He was frustrated. He was used to playing 92% of the snaps, and that just wasn't going to happen. So you kind of clear the decks here. You get some younger players on the field. And this is really not that different than Mike McCarthy's first season in Green Bay way back in 2006. I mean, go back and look at that season. They started off 1-4. I was around that team some that year. You know, they were 4-8 in early December. There was a game where they lost like 35-0 to the Patriots. They got blown out by the Jets. Everybody was talking about, you know, this guy McCarthy, and he's messing everything up. And that was a team that had Brett Favre starting every game. I mean, now here in Dallas, you've got, you know, you're without Dak Prescott. Now you're also down Andy Dalton. You're starting a seventh-round draft pick, Ben DiNucci. And, again, you're without your top four offensive linemen. You know, all that would be challenging enough. But then you also have the problems on defense where you're trying to run a more complicated scheme. And then you got some of the base issues, like your best players have cost you games. I mean, when Ezekiel Elliott fumbles on two consecutive carries, you know, go back and look at the numbers in Mike McCarthy's tenure in Green Bay in turnover margin. They were number two in the NFL. They were like plus 97 over his years there. That was second only to the Patriots in the league. Jason Garrett over 10 years in Dallas was like minus 12. So you've got some bad habits. You got to coach out of people. You normally do that in May, June, July, August. Well, you can't exactly do that as effectively through a computer screen. I told the story on TV yesterday. The first day that they finally got these guys in camp and they busted out the jugs machines, they had three jugs machines, that session went so badly they bought five more because they needed to do more ball drills. They're doing them after walkthrough. They're doing them during every break during practice. I mean, this is a baseline thing. We can't fumble the ball. We can't drop passes. We got to get the ball out. And that's just not something that's kind of been ingrained. So it's a process. Everybody thinks that Jerry Jones should be, you know, after seven games, reversing course on everything he said about Mike McCarthy. None of these are excuses, but they're valuable context to understanding the unique challenge that any first-year head coach would have. But then you throw a global pandemic on top of it, and yeah, it's going to take some time.
Yeah, I guess my only thing is it's about the effort level, and I get that Jerry's his own worst enemy, right? You pay guys that you know, but what's the Chris Carter had this expression, money doesn't change you, it makes you more of who you are, right? You pay some of these guys mm-hmm. that aren't full effort guys, and they're not going to give you. And then there are some guys, Jalen Smith was an effort guy, and his has kind of been lacking. He looks like he can't run again. So It's going to be curious to see how this thing finishes up, because they're still right there to win the division, in spite of the fact that they're an abject disaster in terms of injuries and effort. Let's get to the Packers. There's been discussion about them going out and getting a wide receiver. You mentioned your time covering the Packers. I don't know. I watched that team and I'm like, well, they got blown off the ball by Tampa. You go back to last year when they lost to San Francisco. They couldn't protect Aaron Rodgers, couldn't run the football, couldn't stop the run. I don't think they need another wide receiver as much as they need other help. Where are you on, or where are the Packers on what they might add here for the deadline?
Well, every team would like to add offensive line help. There's just not a lot out there. I mean, right. The Giants are shopping Kevin Zeitler, who's an older player who's making a lot of money. Those are usually the guys that are available. The ones on bad teams who are making a lot of money who are old, which is not at all, if you look at the Packers' history, the type of guys that they would go and acquire. I mean, I agree. I mean, there's definitely something that they're missing in terms of their wide receivers right now. You need a complement to Devontae Adams. And I saw Alan Lazard return to practice today. That's a big deal, because everybody looks at Lazard's receiving numbers, and he has definitely had some big games. But it's all the other things that Alan Lazard does for that offense that they're missing. I mean, you need somebody to go crack on a linebacker. You need somebody to go dig out a safety in the run game. Lazard's your guy. Not to mention that he's also your main intermediate type of a route runner who can do some of those things underneath when guys like Devontae Adams and Marquez Valdez-Scantling are stretching the field. So where do you find that guy? Golden Tate's available. Again, older guy, making a lot of money. You certainly are going to get calls to Houston about the likes of Will Fuller and Kenny Stills, but they're in a unique situation right now where, you know, they fired their head coach, who also doubled as their general manager. I mean, who's even making the final calls on trades? That's where I think that sometimes when you talk about Houston or Atlanta or some of the other teams that may fire general managers, because this could be an unprecedented type of a year in terms of GM turnover, everybody thinks that immediately it's going to be a fire sale for whoever's the interim GM. Well, think about it. If you're trying to hire a new GM, don't you want to keep those assets around? Maybe it's somebody you want to keep on your team, but also maybe you can get better return for that guy in February or March. That's where, you know, you're not going to see a Julio Jones get dealt. You may not even see Houston do as much as some people were expecting after they got rid of Bill O'Brien. You know, there's a very fine line there between balancing, okay, we know we're not winning this year, let's get assets for whatever we can here, and, hey, keeping those assets around until the new guy takes the job actually might help you attract bigger, better candidates because you got more flexibility.
Tom Pelissero, NFL Network, joining us. I don't know if you heard this sound. The Falcons had the ball, and all they have to do is take a knee after getting a first down instead of scoring a touchdown. And this came out today. This is Matt Ryan to Todd Gurley in the huddle before the play in which he scored.
Hey, don't score.
Yeah, I would
don't score.
Down.
Don't score. Get the first. Get the first. Get down.
I mean, couldn't be any more clear, right? I'm like, there's no, he didn't stutter. He didn't say it just once. And like, man, I didn't hear you. He's like, yeah. And he still scored.
That's where sometimes we immediately default to, how could you not coach him up to do that? How do they not know the situation? Well, sometimes you tell guys everything you can, they simply don't execute it. That's where, you know, everybody wants to rag on Todd Gurley, who just kind of gets a little too much momentum going and obviously makes what ends up being a devastating error. But credit Matt Patricia and his staff for coaching it that well, because it wasn't like they just did the floodgates and everybody sat down on the field. They made Todd Gurley feel like, hey, Will Harris is coming to hit me at the five. I better keep my legs going a little more to get to the 1 yard line. Harris releases him at the last possible second, and he falls into the end zone. I mean, those are those situational types of things that you probably drill a million times in practice, or really don't even drill them a million times. You might only drill them a few times, but you talk about those situations in practice, and you may think as a player this is never going to come up, but the Lions executed that to perfection and then put together that drive down the field where, despite the bungling of the officials and everything that happened down there inside the 20 on the final play with 3 seconds to go, Stafford is T.J. Hockenson, and they get a really big win.
What's the reaction been like? I mean, you know everybody in this league. The Dolphins are playing pretty well. They're fighting for a playoff spot. Fitzpatrick's played really well. And, like, look, I don't think he thought he'd keep the job forever. But it was curious timing with that move to install Tua. What's the reaction been like from around the league?
There was definitely some surprise, just because usually when you win two games in a row, and you're game back in the division, I believe they are. You know, that's not generally the time that you make a quarterback change. But I think that if we've seen one thing from Brian Flores over his couple of years as head coach of the Dolphins, it's you have to expect the unexpected. You know, what I was told was it's just time. He looked at the results with Ryan Fitzpatrick, not just the wins and losses, not just the interceptions or the touchdown passes, but what were they getting from him in terms of consistency? And what were they seeing from Tua Tagovailoa in practice? They saw somebody who guys gravitated toward, they believed in, he looked healthy. You know that Fitzpatrick, through the course of his career, has been a streaky player. He'll have really good games. He'll have some poor games. They made a decision here to move forward with the younger player who they think can elevate him. Now, time will tell, and I know everybody immediately jumped to, well, then is Ryan Fitzpatrick going to get traded? Look at Tua's injury history over the past 2 years, and wish you absolutely nothing bad upon a guy.
No, no, but he's been hurt a bunch.
So much.
Yeah, I mean, but you want to play him against Aaron Donald? You want that to be the first game?
Well, I mean, you got to do it sometime. You know, if they had that bye, if the Titans hadn't had their COVID-19 outbreak, if we hadn't rearranged 12 games on the schedule, their bye was going to be in week 11, not in week 7. So it gets accelerated. They still decided this was the time. Get him 2 weeks to get ready and go out there. Now, remember, he's been the backup. He's suited up. So it's not like they've been like, you know, the first hit he takes, something's going to break again. But you do have a guy who, you know, in college, in his last 2 years, if I remember correctly, he broke a bone in his hand twice. Yep. He had a knee injury.
Ankle.
He had two tightrope surgeries on his ankles. And then he had the hip. Yep. The hip dislocation. I mean, those are major types of injuries. And again, I hope, you know, nothing but the best for the kid. He's really fun to watch. But, you know, if I'm the Dolphins, I'm saying to Ryan Fitzpatrick, hey, I know you're disappointed, but you got to be ready because we may be in this division race and somewhere down the line, we still may need you here.
Broncos going to be in the quarterback market this summer?
Well, they seem to like Drew Lock a lot. You know, obviously he's had a couple of injuries here. Most recently, the shoulder injury that he came back from. They've seen glimpses. I don't think John Elway has any appetite to go find a quarterback again. I mean, from Paxton Lynch to Trevor Siemian to Mark Sanchez to, I'm sure, forgetting 10 other guys, Case Keenum, who have suited up since Peyton Manning was done there. They've struggled to fill that position. They think they've got something in Lock. Lock was going into that draft, and I talked to a ton of coaches and scouts and general managers about him. Lock was that guy who you felt like, for no pun intended, you could unlock something with him. There was no box that he didn't check. It was very similar to how people talked about Justin Herbert coming out, which was with Herbert, it was he's got the size, he's got a cannon arm, he's super athletic, he's, you know, not the biggest personality, he's not a typical alpha male for the position, but like everything else, like it's all there. Why wasn't the tape better? And the same thing with Drew Lock. It was, well, everything, yeah, he's kind of a goofy personality, but big guy, strong arm, really athletic, makes some wild throws. You know, why wasn't the tape better? Well, you've seen glimpses of it from Lock. They got to find the consistency. It's really hurt him not having Cortland Sutton out there. I mean, that's his best receiver. Jerry Jeudy's a bright young player. No offense, a good tight end. But you've been challenged with not having your top receiver. I would expect that they're going to continue to give him every opportunity, assuming that this coaching staff and front office is there. And you hope that somewhere on the other end of that, you get some of those Justin Herbert moments where, you know, I had Justin Herbert number 2 in my composite rankings behind Joe Burrow based on all the coaches and scouts I talked to in the last draft. I don't think anybody would have looked at Herbert coming out and said he's going to be this good in his first half of the season in the NFL.
Yeah. Last thing here, real quick. Tom Pelissero joined us from the NFL Network. Is Michael Thomas really hurt, or is he just a pain in the butt?
I mean, he's hurt. I'll leave the other part alone for the moment. But, I mean, the guy's hurt. You know, he was almost back from that high ankle sprain that he suffered back in week 1 a couple of weeks ago. Then he hauls off and punches C.J. Gardner-Johnson in practice, gets suspended for a game. He was back in the building that following week. He talked to the captains. Everything seemed to be fine. And then first practice last week on Wednesday, he tweaks his hamstring. You know, it's one of those things where he can't seem to catch a break. Yeah, he's a guy that he's got a, you know, personality that you manage to a degree. And, you know, with Thomas, it's the thing that makes him great is also what can get in his way sometimes. You know, he's got a big ego. He's got a lot of confidence. And so, you know, in this case, though, it's a legit injury that he's dealing with. Whatever might be so bubbling below the surface, he's got to get healthy. I mean, it's been a long, long couple of months for him, and the Saints certainly could use him.
Tom Pelissero. Tom, great stuff, man. Awesome information, insight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
Tom Pelissero. Check him out on the NFL Network. Follow him on Twitter at Tom Pelissero.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. One of my favorite analysts, favorite Dodgers. He's Eric Karas. He joins us in the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. I know you didn't plan to talk about this, but I'm going to play for you in 1988, and I want you to tell me where you were when give me the Jack Buck. No disrespect to Vin. I think Jack's was better. Here's the call.
Gibson swings and a fly ball to deep right field. This is going to be a home run. Unbelievable! I don't believe what I just saw.
I don't believe what I just saw. Where were you, Eric?
I remember where I was. I was in Arizona Instructional League in a non-air-conditioned home that Bill Benet, our first-round pick of 1988, myself, and Donnie Carroll, second-round pick in 1987, sitting down, having pizza from Domino's, sweating our you-know-what off, watching the game. That's where I was.
I was at, do you know Miles Simon is? He's the
Yeah, absolutely.
Miles and we were childhood friends from fourth grade on. So I was 12, so this is sixth grade, maybe seventh grade, I don't know, 1988, obviously, and fall of 88, yeah, so I was in seventh grade. And he turned to me after the first couple of feeble swings, and he's like, he's going to hit a home run. And I go, get out of here. Like, dude, he can't even walk, right? He's going to hit a home run. And he hits a home run, and his stepdad is like running around their apartment going, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And like, I've loved sports my whole life. I can't think of a moment that I love. And I actually went to game two when Bulldog made it. It was boring because he was so nasty.
Right.
Oh, that was an amazing moment. Like, that's a, what did you think? Do you remember what you were thinking when you were watching him?
I couldn't believe it. You know, right? It's just dramatic and everything, but, you know, more worried about having to go practice the next day in Arizona. Okay. Instructional League. And more concerned why the house didn't have air conditioning in Phoenix.
Who does that? Like, they build the houses without air conditioning in Phoenix?
Dude, this was back in the early 80s, right? Late 80s.
They had air conditioning in the 80s. I mean, I just want to point out.
Hey, the salaries that we were on, sure, as minor leaguers, right? That had to take what we could afford.
Okay, Blake Snell's out there dealing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of the Kevin Cash decision?
We all first guessed it, right? And right. Said, how can you do this? And just look at, I'm all for analytics. I'm a big proponent of it. But I think any successful organization, it's a combination of the two. And the eye test tells me the way that Bellinger swings at some of these pitches, he's got no chance. The way that Mookie Betts goes after these pitches. I mean, Joe Girardi said it best once where, look, I can tell how good a guy's throwing. I don't need to look at numbers. I don't need to look at exit velocity. I just need to look at the opponent's swings. And
he's a former the thing about Kevin is, like, the reason – you mentioned Girardi, and obviously you're a former player, and going, but the reason the catchers get the gig, right, is because they have great feel. You can't be a catcher and a good one unless you have not just complete knowledge of what's going on, but you got to have feel. I feel like you're taking away the whole reason you hire a catcher to be the manager when you go by the book.
Was he a good catcher?
I don't know.
I'm just kidding.
He played a long time. He couldn't be terrible.
But see,
couldn't hit at all, by the way. 183 career hitter, so he must have been an incredible defensive catcher.
Well, I mean, so here's the thing on this. So if it's not already pre-planned or it's not mapped out, what did Blake Snell have to do, or what did he have to pitch like to pitch six innings or seven innings? You know what I'm saying?
You can't pitch any better than he was pitching.
Right. Well, that's the whole point. And I get that it's what they've been doing all year. I completely get it. In fact, yes. I watched he pitched the second game against the Astros in the playoffs. Kevin Cash took him out in the fifth inning. He had been pitching well, and Snell was hot. He was hot coming off the mound. And then the inning blew up. Castillo came in, gave up a few hits, and they panned the dugout afterwards. And you could see all the guys on the team are in little clusters, you know, two and three guys, and they're talking. And I know what that conversation is. You know, I've been there. They're all sitting there going, dude, what is he doing? How did he take him out? You know, everybody's talking. But that's what they've been doing all year long. But again, this is postseason. Postseason is not regular season. Those are two different animals.
Yeah,
it's two different animals. That's why Billy Beane always says, look, at the postseason's a crapshoot. I can tell you how many games I'm going to win during the regular season. I can be within four or five, you know, unless of a major. But the postseason, you can't do what you've done all year long. You can't. You have to adjust. And Dave Roberts made adjustments. In the postseason.
Yeah. No, I mean, he'd seen enough from, we'd all seen enough from Kenley, and to get, do you think Urias is the guy heading forward?
Oh, man. So here's the thing. Did anybody map that out?
No.
That he was going to close a few games? Right?
No.
No. Right. And so that's the thing. He, you know, Dave went with what he saw and, you know, what the numbers said. It was a combination of the two. So is he a – no, he's a starter. I mean, there's no way you –
Okay. Here's something that bothers me.
Okay.
I know you're looking for one pitch and get another. The last two – they don't swing at strike three? Like, I don't know. I understand it's at so much a higher level than I conceptual. I have an 11-year-old son, and it drives me crazy when he looks at strike three. Like, hey, dude, you gotta put that sucker in play. Dude, you know, just foul it off. I mean, they didn't move on strike three.
So they're looking for something. They're looking for something to drive. They're fooled. Look, at that level, too, now with the velocity, the way guys can manipulate the ball, I mean, it's almost – and it's an educated guess. It's not I'm up there and I'm just trying to see something and I'm just going to – it's about making hard contact, too, because the fielding, the positioning of the fielders, I mean, it's not – you know, everybody talks about, oh, just put the bat on the ball. Well, that doesn't work anymore. That doesn't work anymore because, you know, it's why Corey Seager can play a great shortstop. Do you know why? Because he's in the right place all at the right time.
Yes.
Is it instinctive? No. You're looking at that little card you have in your you know, pocket that says, look, I need to be 3 feet over here. So it's much more difficult. The game is not about just putting the bat on the ball and, oh, we're going to hit and run. It's changed, and you're either going to accept it and get on board or you can fight it and lose.
E.K. Erkerik's joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Speaking of the shift, I mean, there were some hard-hit balls, you know, that shallow right field where I think Buck was even fooled. Like, oh, there's a hard hit. Like, it's like to the second baseman who's playing in right field.
Right.
look, they made some – I give the commissioner credit. Like, take the DH is universal, although it's going back at least for a year. The three – I like the three hitter rule. I just
pitcher,
do it.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a new it's different math and yet different equation, and it takes away those, you know, the constant turnstile of lefty lefty righty righty, etc. But in your mind, should they, you know, draw a line down the middle of the field and, you know, left side's got to stay on left side, right side's got to stay on right side?
So right, I've heard a lot of people talk about that, right? There's football, there's illegal defenses, basketball, there's illegal defenses. So, you know, why not in baseball? Why not having to have a certain number of players on one side of the field, you know, using second base as your divider? I think probably that makes more sense to create more action, but then you're going to change the approach to hitting, and then you're going to change pitching. And I think, look, at the reality is you've got to figure out a way. You've got to figure out a way to beat the shift. You've got to figure out, wait, you know, does that mean bunting? Does that mean, you know, the left-hander just, you know, sacrificing something, you know, over to the third base side? You know, all those sort of things, you've got to continue to adjust. If I saw a rule that said, you know, put certain number of guys on each side of the base, I probably wouldn't mind it, because I know as a hitter, that would be frustrating as hell. As a left-handed hitter, I hit a line drive into short right center and, you know, the guy's standing there. And it's, you know, it's tough enough to hit in the big leagues, and it just makes it even that much more difficult.
The thing is, like, look, the reason that all these rules are put in place in football, right, where you can't touch a wide receiver more than 5 yards down the field now, and, you know, now the RPOs in college football where offensive linemen get like 3 yards down the field, even on a pass play. The whole idea is offense. Right?
Same with basketball, right?
And basketball, the hand checking and the change in the illegal defenses or whatever, it's all for offense. And, like, I get you still win with pitching, defense, and timely hitting, but in an effort to make the game more watchable, people want to see more guys cross home plate. And, look, 33% of all at-bats are pitcher, catcher, and hitter because a guy hits a home run, walks, or strikes out, right? Like, we got to get back to getting balls in play.
But, see, here's the thing is people love power, right? And so you can do all the studies you want. People love to see home runs. They love to see
they
home runs.
They do. Chicks do need the long. But the waiting in between the home runs can be interminable, right? It just can. They like to see it in highlights, but the process of it, because there's more home runs than ever, but it's not as good a watch.
But who says it's not as good a watch?
Well, the national numbers, I guess.
Is that because the game is more boring, or because there's alternative things, or because it's not marketed properly, right? There's so many variables. I think that, okay, so you know what? I'm going to change the defensive requirements in Major League Baseball. Hey, attendance went up. Hey, the TV ratings went up. No way. There's no correlation.
Okay.
I got
a couple more quick ones, and you've been more than generous with your time. We're focusing on the Snell thing. That game's not ending 1-0. I kind of feel like we're giving the Rays a pass. They ran themselves out of two innings in game. It was in game five, right?
Right.
Was that a bigger factor that no one's going to pay attention to because Kevin Cash pulled Blake Snell?
Well, I think because Kevin Cash pulled Blake Snell.
Yeah.
And look, the reality is the Dodgers are a better team. They're on paper, they're a better team. They win that series. And if you don't have that crazy ending, right, game five. We're talking about something completely different. So there's a lot of what ifs and, hey, what could have been and all that sort of thing. But I look at the Blake Snell thing, and it deserves all the attention because that – I'm not sure there's one person outside of Kevin Cash, which is a gutsy move, that would have made that decision.
I got it. Yeah. No, I got it. And it wasn't as obvious as, like, it wasn't like when Grady Little took out Pedro.
Right.
Nobody wants to be Grady Little in that one. How do we view Kershaw now?
Hall of Famer.
He's a Hall of Famer before.
And postseason, but look at this. So here's the thing. If you look at what he's done historically in the postseason, I mean, you could take innings. You take innings out of it, you know, four or five innings, and it's an unbelievable postseason. Look, he was dominant here, and this is the first time that they didn't ask him to do more than what he needed to do.
Right.
They didn't ask him to come out of the pen. They didn't ask him to save a game. They didn't ask him. I mean, he was handled perfectly, and he responded.
Awesome stuff. This is historically great Dodger team. Will the shortened season – will the shortened season and the fact there weren't fans there, wasn't in Dodger Stadium, will that change how we look? Because they were on pace to win 116.
Yeah.
They outscored people. Does it change how they'll be viewed historically?
I'd argue that this championship this year was probably more difficult to win than any other year. Not just besides having to play baseball, but all the other variables that you had to deal with, whether it was just staying COVID-free, whether it was the way you prepare, whether it was how disciplined you had to be, how responsible you had to be to your teammates. I mean, without question, this was arguably the most mentally draining season for any player, coach, organization, and what, you know, whoever won, whether it was the Dodgers or anybody else. I mean, you know, I heard somebody else say, you don't get an asterisk by your team name, you should get a star. Because it truly separates from any other team.
From humble beginnings of some shack in Phoenix, Arizona with no air conditioning.
Right, there
to being
you go.
To being a star with the Dodgers, now a star on the MLB on Fox. Eric Karros. E, thanks so much for joining.
Hey, thanks for having me, Doug. All right, take care, buddy.
The best. And incredible hair, by the way. I just want to point out Eric Karros, incredible hair.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.